From WGBH Radio and PRI, this is Innovation Hub. Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. In 1961, if you had a television at home, you probably got just a couple of channels with shows like Bonanza or The Flintstones or The Andy Griffith Show.
What it is, Pa, is that nowadays kids get 75 cents a week allowance instead of 25 cents.
75 cents? That's a lot of money.
Critics, though, were already groaning. That year, Newton Minow famously called TV a vast wasteland, which is something that I agree with at least a couple nights a week. Scholar Jason Mattel says, forget the wasteland. Despite the fact that we're now distracted by a barrage of gadgets, whether it's a Fitbit or an iPhone, our attention span for quality TV is actually getting longer. Technology is pushing us towards nuanced, layered, edgy plots. Jason Mattel is a professor at Middlebury College and the author of Complex TV. Jason, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
So how is TV getting more complex?
Well, it's been around 20 years or so that there's been a real shift in how television tells stories. It used to be that people needed to be able to pick up an episode and follow what was going on in that episode, and then maybe they would miss a few episodes, go back, and then watch another episode. And so every story had to be, if not self-contained, at least explicable on its own. And what we've seen from primarily the 2000s to today is that most primetime storytelling assumes that viewers are watching regularly. It assumes that viewers are engaging with the show in the chronological order of the episodes. And because of that, there's a greater deal of seriality and self-aware storytelling mechanics.
That seems like it's taking a big chance, right? Because in some ways, the idea of being able to drop in has its charms versus, you know, you must be up with the episode and know all these complex characters.
Definitely. And there are certainly many shows that still have the episodic model. So some of the most popular shows on television, like Big Bang Theory or NCIS, you can watch an individual episode and skip around a great deal. And those are the shows that do the best in reruns, which is the traditional way that television made money in the long term.
I believe I've isolated the algorithm from making friends.
But some of these other programs, more serialized programs that are definitely popular on premium cable like HBO and Showtime, as well as basic cable, FX and AMC, demand a much more consistent viewership. And they do get lower ratings, but they're the shows that people tend to talk more about. They tend to get the most critical praise, the awards, and really they captivate viewers in a different way.
Now, you said we're in this kind of 20-year shift. What precipitated that shift? Why has storytelling changed?
There are a few reasons. One major reason is a shift in the industry. Back in what we might call the classic network era, when there were at first three and then four with Fox networks, you needed to have a really sizable audience to be considered a hit. So a show that got 20 or 30 million viewers a week was performing very well. Today, you can have a show that's getting 4 to 5 million viewers a week and have it considered a hit, certainly on cable, but even on network. And part of that is just because there's so many more programs. Today, there are more than 300 scripted primetime programs in a given year. And that way exceeds what the norm was back in the 80s. And because of that, you'd need a much smaller chunk of the audience to be considered successful. Another really big shift is in technology. Back in the 80s, if you missed an episode, oh well. If you were one of the very few people who knew how to program your VCR, maybe you could time shift. But most people didn't do it. So you could catch it up in reruns, but reruns were not usually chronological, and you couldn't guarantee when you'd be able to see it. Starting in the late 90s, you started to see the rise of television on DVD. And that really opened the door for storytellers to say, oh, we can assume that viewers will be able to watch in chronology, much the way that 19th century serial literature worked. So Dickens published most of his novels in weekly or monthly installments, and then once they were all done, in a one-bound volume, and readers could choose the way in which they engaged or do both. And then with the rise of digital video recorders, people could time shift a lot more. So even though you could do it with a VCR, many, many more people embrace DVRs to be able to time shift and bank a number of episodes, or if they're out a given night, they can watch it another time.
Right.
And then now, most recently, the rise of streaming. So via Netflix or Amazon, there's almost a guarantee that, oh, I can watch it at my own pace.
Did you think I'd forgotten you? Perhaps you hoped I had. Don't waste a breath mourning, Miss Barnes. Every kitten grows up to be a cat. They seem so harmless at first, small, quiet, lapping up their saucer of milk. But once their claws get long enough, they draw blood, sometimes from the hand that feeds them.
And that changes the type of stories that can be told. And I think that really enables viewers to consume a show the way that they want to. If they want to keep up weekly because they enjoy the discussion and being in the know of what's happening, they can do that. Or if they want to wait and be able to control the pace and know, okay, I have three seasons that I can watch in a compressed format, or what people sometimes call binge viewing.
So what's interesting to me is that the idea of television getting more complicated or more nuanced, I think in some ways would run counter to what you would think. So, you know, if you think about 1960 and today, a lot of people would argue we've got shorter attention spans now because we're surrounded by technology all the time. Maybe we want more salacious material. But you're saying the opposite, which is maybe, but we can handle things that are more sophisticated, more interwoven than we could in 1960.
Yeah, I'd say it's both. So it's not as if television has become, you know, an elite highbrow medium. There's still a lot of trashy programs in all sorts of genres, and some of them are great, and that's fine. But I think that what it's doing is, because you can succeed with a smaller audience who can
right.
take control of their own viewing, you can have a program that back in the 60s would be considered a niche cult phenomenon. And it can be a really big success today. So I think that that's the change that's happening. The other aspect is that you could argue that we have shorter attention spans because of technology, but we also have the ability to dive in and to drill into a program deeper because of technology. So at the same time that television has become more complex, the internet has enabled a fan base to embrace what I call forensic fandom, where fans can gather together on a wiki or on Twitter or on a blog and analyze a program and talk about the references to other episodes or the intertextual references to other media. And this allows television storytellers to spin much more complicated and less redundant stories, because the assumption is, well, if people didn't follow what was going on, they can just look it up online.
Right, right. You can read the synopsis of episode 5 easily. You just Google it, right?
Exactly. And for many of these sites, the rise of recap culture, where you have television critics who have become, you know, quite popular in running online weekly reviews. This never happened in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
not only because there was no online, but there was no weekly review of episodes. If you reviewed an episode of television, it was usually just the pilot. And the question was, should I keep watching this?
Right.
Whereas now you have critics who their business is every week they put up another review of a popular program, and then a group of readers will gather there and talk in the comments about the program. And it really becomes a shared participatory culture. And television is both enabling and encouraging that type of engagement.
Do you think that that change in culture actually changes Hollywood, like changes what gets greenlighted, the discussions people have in producers' offices, in the offices of network bosses? Is it changing that whole process?
100%. So television writers realize that there are fans who are doing this type of forensic examination, and some programs will actually give them little what they call toys to play with, or Easter eggs, so that, you know, there's a puzzle or something they know that they're going to be able to talk about in the forums. Other programs, there's a real sense of this is going to cater to a cult audience, but this cult audience is an audience that our advertisers want to reach. So that's really driving the type of program. And then there are also some cable channels who really made their name through this program. AMC is a great example.
It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. It's not called the wheel. It's called the carousel.
Mad Men, which just ended, was never a ratings sensation. It actually got very low ratings. Pretty much any network show gets more viewership than Mad Men.
Which is incredible because it got so much attention. The fashion on it got attention. The, you know, the layouts of the rooms got attention. Everything got attention on Mad Men. And it's so funny to hear you say it didn't actually get that many viewers.
Right. It was a very small viewer base, but passionate and very influential. So it was a high culture viewer base, the people who were having these conversations, it got who were working, you know, as journalists and advertisers who would then talk about the show in their different media. But what it did for AMC was it made them a legitimate channel. 10 years ago, AMC was not something you would ever, you know, choose to watch. Maybe there was a movie on that you stumbled across. Mad Men made it legitimate, and then Breaking Bad followed very soon. That made this a channel that could program some adventurous, innovative, and high-profile programs.
The methylamine keeps flowing no matter what. We are not ramping down. We're just getting started.
Do you think television creators now are less worried about the molds that used to be so clear? You know, there were sitcoms, there were dramas, there were miniseries. Are they less worried about fitting into those molds than they once would have been?
I think that the genres that really have dominated television for decades are still there. There are still half-hour sitcoms. There are still cop shows. There are lawyer shows. There are medical shows. And I think they're going to persist. However, a lot of these programs embrace genre mixing, allow themselves to play with these boundaries. So some of the most acclaimed dramas are actually very, very funny. The Wire and Breaking Bad are funny programs. Some of the most celebrated comedies actually have very dramatic character arcs as well. So I think that there's this sense that you can play with these norms because, again, you're going for a smaller audience, an audience that wants something that isn't normal. They want something that's innovative and breaking the norms.
I wonder if you think there's a show or two that doesn't get enough credit for being creative and being groundbreaking. It could be something that's on now, or it could be something that, you know, has gone off the air.
Wow. There are a lot of programs. One of the challenges of television is that some of the most innovative things get canceled. Yeah. And, you know, it used to be that these things never were viewed again. But if you now, with the era of Netflix or DVD, you actually can view some of these old shows. Some of my favorite shows that did not get hailed or got some critical buzz but didn't last. One was a great show called Terriers.
Looks like Gustafson can only hold them off so long. It must be an APB out of
it. You said there's a PB&J out on me?
Yeah.
That was on FX for a season that told the story of two sort of low-rent private eyes. And it did so in a really innovative method with a really unique tone. But it just didn't fit the sort of the branding of what FX was going for. But it's a really great show that you can still catch up on online. It was produced by Sean Ryan, who did The Shield. And another really, really interesting show that's on now that gets very bad ratings in the U.S., but I think is one of the most innovative and really challenging things ever to be seen on American television is Hannibal, which is the story of Hannibal Lecter prior to Silence of the Lambs.
Friendship can sometimes involve a breach of individual separateness.
You're not my friend. The light from friendship won't reach us for a million years. That's how far away from friendship we are.
I imagine it's easier to believe I'm responsible for those murders than it is to accept that you are.
And I think a lot of people assumed, oh, this is going to be a sort of cash-in, you know, just sort of adapt something to create a buzz.
Right.
But it's actually, for my money, it's actually the best telling of the story of Hannibal Lecter. It's much more arty and much more, I think, has a certain level of not only narrative complexity, but emotional complexity.
Well, what's that saying a lot? Because Silence of the Lambs won many Oscars, I believe.
Sure, it did. And you know, for me, Hannibal actually is, I think, much more accomplished than Silence of the Lambs.
Jason Mattel is a professor of film and media culture at Middlebury College, and he is the author of Complex TV. Jason, this is great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I love my soul.